Thank you so much for inviting me to Avail Hall. Thank you. It's great to be here. There's one thing I'm just going to mention. I'm going to read some poems tonight and an extract from my short story collection, The Scattering. But there's just one thing I'll get out of the way, because sometimes it causes confusions in the poems that I read, and that's just my accent. I was born and brought up in London, but my mother inherited a house in Dundalk when I was 12 years old, so we all moved to Ireland. And ever since then, I've had a sort of Ireland, London background. I'm sure you know lots of people like me. Anyway, a lot of the poems sort of feature or refer to my parents in some way, for some reason. Chamomile. Fair, fur-headed sisters, all on one woody stem. My mother would gather your blonde dye heads from the parks of Kilburn and Hampstead and boil you up, gold for her hair and for her children's, though I was dark as a secret. Your bombshells sweeten the air. An infusion of your whole dried body calms the unquiet part of the heart and worries kidney stones. From the Greek karma melon, meaning earth apple, your yellow melon heads indiscriminately perfume battlefields as they do suburban lawns, and bring today to this cluttered desk my mother, that platinum haired apothecary. This next poem is a sonnet about dandelions once they've lost that lovely yellow colour and they're those sort of silver blue shapes. Still life of dandelions in fruit after Jen Hetfield. On this bank are hawkbit, rough sow thistle and silver dandelions, cinder-hearted wishes of star-shaped seeds, clocks with the hours variously gone. The long green spines are lined with milk that smells like weird weedy piss. No pining for the days of yellow amongst dandelions, for this is the arrival point, a standing two in grey-haired splendour, hitching for every seed a ride on wind, kittiwake, child or fox cub. Their terms of parting. Unlock yourself. Make me a cold, bare star. Go off, 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 into the air. My dad died this year, sadly. He'd been very ill for years. For the past few years, he was in a nursing home in a place outside Florida called Termin Fecken. We used to laugh at that name. There's a lot of fecks in Ireland. the waves at Termin Fecken. After we visit my father in the home, we walk along the beach past Baltray. The tide is coming in softly, but across the tide's trajectory at a tangent is another, a wand of thin waves, untroubling the path of the ubertide closing fast on us. I think of him then, stubborn, always firm in his difference, as if he had an instinct impossible to deny, to go against the grain. With my father, everything was west of Ireland, this or that, though he lived in the northeast for 4 decades and in London for 2. The countercurrent brings its deviant waves to the widening sea at Clawhead, where no doubt it will fade, its crisscross pattern like the black restitch of an Aran garment slacken into the mainstream. Or perhaps not. For who knows the every movement of the sea? Who knows their parents fully, the whole story? Who knows themselves? Or the why and wherefore of a briefly defiant wave. This is a new poem. It's a sonnet. It's about not writing and not writing for a while and what that feels like. I've never read this before. Winteridge. When I become 3/4 drudge, 1/4 writer, and the pen is not on the page, I think of all the squashed and silent talents of the earth, all the women who were artists, but who spent their days instead caring for children or the sick, and wonder if it is really such a loss. There has been much love poured into my tasks, into the cleaning jobs, the endless feeding of cats, the dying father visited. These are not sacrifices. They are poems still, unwritten, future subjects. The heart and mind continues to churn the matter over, like those Burren cows sent up to the highlands for a 5-month winter. When they come down, having turned the earth to mud, to bulrushes and cuckoo flowers, some will have carved and brought to life the mountain tops while seemingly banished from the farm for the long season. We eventually sold that house that my mother inherited, and my mum had died by then, but we wanted to move my dad into another house. So we sort of saw for the first time a lot of the objects that had been in that inherited house, because I'd never really seen them in isolation. They come with the house, if you like. Heirlooms. Sometimes the things of the dead make small utterances. That basket of sunflowers a yogi wove in Dublin reminds me of a warm kitchen with folded aprons, ham sandwiches served on the gold-flecked vest and tea. Things inherited, snapshots of aunts in Blackpool, signal to me like beacons in the darkness of the house. This matchbox from the Isle of Man, the mustard jar, pearled, miniatures of girls in an iris field, one of them familiar. Some nights are quiet enough to cling to and remember. What we miss is the habitual, the clutter of drawers and walls, a fire after a blizzard, a long-dead mother's laughter, church bells you knew the whole estate had listened to in winter. I have a couple of political poems for you. This one I wrote the execution of Troy Davis in America. I just found that very disturbing. And the poem was eventually included in Amnesty International book of human rights poems. The Kestrel, in memory of Troy Davis. On the morning they kill Troy Davis, the air outside is still and sodden. Birdsong is unremarkable, and I think of yesterday's kestrel. My neighbor had seen it descend on a pigeon gorging on worms and scraps of bread laid out by Anne, who lives 3 doors up. He said that watching the feathered frenzy was Morris, my cat, who, prominent under Anne's hedge, seemed transfixed by the sight of a bird killing a bird. Yet Morris and I both know, though it's me who needs reminding, that everything is prey, and that instinctively each species will not protect itself. And although they prayed in Georgia, a man still walked to his dying, where others of his kin had come to swoop and hollow him out. This next sort of political poem I wrote, what I call sort of peak recession in Ireland in 2011. Up sort of where I live by the border, I'm sure it's the same here, everything just seemed to stop. Building stopped and I would pass by yards, sort of half-built estates, and nature just started to seem as if it was reclaiming everything. And, you know, it was difficult to know when this would ever end. It feels like we're coming out of it now, but 2011 was, one would wonder. I also quote something from an essay by Thomas McCarthy from Irish Pages. Ireland, 2011. Our country has been undone. Thomas McCarthy, The Years of Forgetting, 2006 to 2011. I have tried to believe in Pound's Canto 81 for most of these past 3 years, as the post-Lehman's, post-Lenehan world hurtles from dark to dark, and fear is the old new currency. The piebalds are gone from my neighbor's fields. Wildness has reclaimed each building site. Through earth and clinker it has risen, and now parades a green, triumphant face. This land has a mind of its own, and it wants everything back. It has made a parody of Pounds. What thou loves best shall not be reft from thee. From some towns in the country, the people have run without warning or lament, as if from the Black Death. While there is a street, they say, in Melbourne, where everyone hails from Cavan. On a lighter note, it's a poem about lawnmowers. Woodstock. On Saturdays in summer, the sounds of lawnmowers harmonize, a random weave of metallic notes scored in the style of Steve Reich or John Cage. Ken next door has been doing the street's verge voluntarily for years. His is a Hitachi with hints of Schenker and Hendrix. We use a Husqvarna Mark I, and its notes are precise, though slightly Texas chainsaw, which scares the cats. Anjo across the road, who does everything there herself, pushes a Flymo, which has the lofty hum of a razor or hairdryer. Ken calls it a woman's machine. Peter, from around the corner, uses a clunky red thing that sounds like a glockenspiel. He did my dad's verge last week. Peter's a bit of a control freak, and I think would rather die than let other people's grass grow. My dad, who is new to the area, has never pushed a mower in his life, not unless you count sheep or cows, as he grew up on a large farm. The long and sloping lawn of Coogan's requires the sit-down variety that sounds like a drum and leaves the pale and dark stripe pattern of a rugby jersey. Except Mr. Coogan, who owns a picture framing shop, is not very visual, and his lines always collapse to a crooked V. The acoustics rattle the street, and all the animals hide, but I find it a comfort listening to my neighbours pout in the open air, making their illogical sounding folk music. Late Summer Sonnet. What is that in the field air glinting in the corner of my eye and a head punctuating the green? It is too tall for hay, and these marzipan-coloured stalks are thick and cut into like a quarry. It's not a gold mine, though this seam is wide. And whenever I see the swathes of this thing, especially from a train or car on a late summer's day, the only movement is on the surface, where it seems lighter, like coral in seawater, or a profound heart that is never given away. And then I remember, this is Bali. My father talked about it. Walking across it cut, he said, was like walking through fire. And finally, final poem. This poem won the 2010 John Lennon Poetry Prize. I entered that competition mainly because it was free to enter. I like entering free. I do recommend enter free ones.
I take up on that.
Yeah, you know, you can't lose. And because the judge was Carol Ann Duffy, and I love Carol Ann Duffy's work, but I knew nothing about John Lennon. So I thought, I have to come at this from an angle because everybody's, you know, you notice it's probably going to be, we'll know a lot. And I found a magazine, a Cara magazine, on a flight from Dublin to London with an article by Tamsin Day Lewis talking about Mayo and this island that John Lennon had bought. Now, I know this is the subject of Kevin Barry's new novel. I'm aware of that. But I just wanted to say I had written this 5 years before. The subject is sort of different in that I imagine Yoko's still living. She's still alive. Sorry, Yoko's gone to the island. She's living on the island. They haven't sold it. And that Lennon takes the shape of a seal, so he's a selkie, in order to be with her. The Selkie of Dorinish. In 1967, John Lennon purchased Dorinish Island in County Mayo. Before his death in 1980, he and Yoko discussed building a home there. She has come to love meadow sweet and rubs its germaline smell into her sallow skin. In the evening, she gathers wingnuts for her new artwork and makes eyes and beady lines from black bluebell seeds. Around the cottage are the trees I planted as seedlings in 67, Spanish oak, a row of limes and elder, and everywhere the stark green water on which at night the mainland throws its gold and amber albers. Sometimes ships will stop for stones for ballast on the western beach. Once a sailor saw me changing from my wetsuit. Then Yoko came and we three sat together, drinking and watching the grey Atlantic skies burst open with light. There is an island for every day of the year in Kulu, and here we should have come after she'd had her New York premonition, but better late than never. She keeps the house now and I the sea around it. In winter she collects her kindling in the morning, wearing lamb's wool boots that make no sound. If out, I'll cast an eye across and at Pope Patrick, then watch the mist fall over Inishcuttle, thick as sealskin on the reeling sea. Thank you very much, thank you. I'm just going to follow with a short extract from Scattering. This is from the longer story in the book called Jailbird. And there is a few things I need to tell you. Michael McDade lives in a shop with a house attached with his mother. His mother Connie, she was a sort of well-known amateur actress, was known as the Meryl Streep, this is all set in Wynnum, she was known as the Meryl Streep of Castlemoyne. He used to be in a very well-known band that was compared to Nirvana.
What was it called?
I actually forget.
I better check that out.
I can't remember the name of the band. That's a very good question. I was in a band called Choice, I don't think I ever named it, that's very important, and I don't think it's ever said in the story. Good one. but the band was compared to Nirvana, and in that band there was a singer who he was very much in love with, but Connie, the mother, was so domineering, and after the death of his brother, who was supposed to have taken his insulin and didn't, she sort of made him smash up the band. Anyway, Martha has gone to America, become very successful, and now she's come back. So we now meet Michael meeting Martha for the first time after a long gap. And there's one else, another thing you need to know. In the intervening years, yeah, the only friends Michael really has now are the foxes at the back of the house in the bog. Okay. Martha stood on the highest hill. The evening was fine, the sun fat and low in the sky. Before us, the bog simmered. Everywhere, bees and flies swirled about plants that had been growing there for as long as I could remember. Foxtail, vetch, purple moorgrass, bog cotton, tormentil, deer sedge, bog asphodel, bindweed, ling, sundew. The land below us was covered in lush-looking crops, and the haze of them breathing filled the air. The rushes shook by the stream behind us. The gorse throbbed with light. Out on the heather I'd lain a flask of tea, the leftovers of cocoa scraps for the foxes and my cigarettes. I lay back and watched the fleet bog wind blow through Martha's hair, as if pulling it up and out by invisible marionette strings as she leapt from rock to rock. It could have been 20 years ago. It was like no time had passed at all, as if it had been breached somehow, folded back on by this tryst at the top of the bog, like those we'd had many years before. Ladies Bray, Devlin's, Pat Mays, Daly's, Keedy, and over there Dundalk, Dundalk Bay. That's cheating, I shouted. She was naming places that could not be seen with the naked eye. The Manor, Lawhill, Masshill, Shercock, Shanko Duff, Bally Bay, Cassidy's and McDay's. What's the biggest hill? Masshill. Who owns the blue sheep? Henry's. She plucked a stem of bog cotton and said she'd missed the bog flowers. I couldn't believe how much she remembered. Once I'd have won this game we were playing of naming places that could be seen from the bog, which divided McDade's land from Cassidy's. It seemed the place names had stayed more alive in Martha's memory than in my own, and me living all this time beside them. It's the details help you hang on to a place, Michael, when you're away as long as me, Martha said. She had wanted to see the spot where once we would have our chats, our private liaisons, and I agreed to show her my foxes. After an hour or so, it was clear there would be no detail of our history here together that she would leave untouched. To deflect, I asked her about herself, how life had been in America, but she was vague about it, said her friends had helped her, and that she'd ended up in some weird town in California, near Roswell, where she'd had some brainwave/epiphany thing which had launched her forward. The details of this she was not talkative about. I presumed it was only she didn't want to be yammering on all the time about how successful she was. Martha had always been a most modest person. Where was it you did it, Michael? She said then, as I sort of knew she would eventually, and I felt my bones chill. I looked at her and knew from the wide, earnest eyes of her exactly what she meant. Over there, I said, and pointed to a flat stretch of lichen close to the stream. I was sort of annoyed she brought the matter up. I wanted to ask, did she want to erect a fucking plaque there or what, but of course I didn't. She turned away. You were a god, Michael, do you know that? She said, her back to me. What? I said. You heard. Remember you drove into that gig on a motorbike? Sort of, I said, and I started thinking again about our days in the band. Where was that? Riverside Inn, I replied. That's it, you see, you've not forgotten. Like fucking Kurt Cobain, you were, remember? It was so... Martha didn't finish her sentence. She didn't have to. I knew what she meant. Things changed, Martha, I said. After Eugene, I couldn't let Ma down. She was a bloody mess after all. You tried to kill yourself, Michael, and I totally blame her. To this, I said the words, it wasn't because of Ma at all. Well, I mouthed them without volume, because I was nervous, had felt I was hitherto coming across like I suffered from Tourette's syndrome, so I held back, possibly on the one thing I should have said outright to her. I realised that in all the years we'd been apart, she still did not know why I'd come up to the bog that day. She thought it was to do with my mother's usual prodding and poking. I saw, too, that Martha still had the old confidence in me, still saw in me that God, as she put it. So how could I tell her I'd come up here like a ninny, missing my dead brother, pull this way and that, by my mother's attempts to wreck my life as she had Eugene's, stuck between love and guilt and sick with the indecision, at once paralyzed and overwhelmed and taken a blade to my own arms because of her, because she was going to leave me here alone in this closed and sodden tomb of the county. That night, I arrived home to find Marv had bolted the door. I'd had a few jars with Marv in town and walked her back on the balmy night to Josie's, her aunt's place. In the pub, we bumped into a few old faces, including Noel, who ran his father's butchers on High Street. He drummed with us for a while. Everyone was glad to see us. In fact, the whole evening had been rather wonderful. And I was closer to feeling like a god this first night with Martha than I'd felt in a long time. "Open the door, Ma," I shouted up at the window. No sound. Then the curtains were wrenched back, and I could see her staring down at me, glasses on, chocolate brown hairnet pinned to her head, no doubt to protect for Coco Conway those grey, golden, Meryl Streepish locks of hers. "Come on, Ma, open the door," I shouted. I could hear her footsteps then, heavy on the stairs, and eventually she unlocked the door, making a big ceremonious deal out of the whole lot, the bolts, the mortise lock, and opened it slightly with the chain still on and looked straight at me, her own and only living son. "Who is it?" she said. "Jesus, fuck, you know it's me, Ma. You just looked down at me from the window." And then this long black shotgun was being pointed at me and I screamed. As soon as she pulled back, I burst clean through the door, breaking the chain. When I stumbled in, Ma was up against the stairs, pointing the yoke straight at me. I honestly thought she would fire. I could see something dark and cruel in her. In all the years we've been cooped up in this house together, which was bad enough after Eugene and worse after my father died, I'd never directly encountered this look, but I had felt it. In every sarcastic comment, in the way she'd know tenderness for me, not at any time or in any situation, in how she would mock the music I listened to and denounce my fox feeding to the worst animal haters that would come into the shop. Now in the half dark of the room, I saw her for real, sort of maskless. I saw with alcohol-derived clarity that there was something caught, trapped between us, that was almost creaturish, like an albatross weighed down and entangled in net. It was Blaine. "I fucking knew it," I said to myself, as she stood there in her long white nightdress that was shamefully flimsy, and bare feet with the rough skin toes all painted up in a brash persimmon coloured nail varnish, her eyes ablaze and narrow like a snake or a fox about to pounce on a rat. She blamed me for Eugene. I'd always the sense that because I was in a band, she thought it must have been me who dragged Eugene into the scene he was in, but he was well capable of finding his own trouble. "You were out with that one," she said. "Who's that one? That hussy, the Cassidy one." "Don't talk about her like that," I said quite viciously, near enough forgetting about the gun, though like I said, I'd had a few jars. I pulled back then, just to be on the safe side. "Put the gun down, Ma, for fuck's sake. She was never any good." I let out a big sigh, went to the door, saying I'd sleep in the barn, as I couldn't stand to listen to her anymore, nor be in the same house with someone pointing a gun at me. "Come back, Michael," she said, seeing me go to leave. When I stopped, she went to the cupboard under the stairs, lodged the gun inside, covered it with a few coats, and closed the door. "Pretty bloody handy with that gun, aren't you, Ma?" "Never know what scum I'd be calling these nights," she said. "And besides, wouldn't a mother need a gun with a son like you? Comes in stocious drunk with a big foul breath on him." Well, I couldn't resist. It was like those articles I'd read in the shop when I was bored, which was most days, about people in Northern England or Southern America who supposedly had out-of-body experiences. That's what it felt like as I lunged at my own mother and let out an enormous stinky breath directly into her face. She screwed up her eyes and mouth with the repugnancy of it, turned away. "Oh, this is what she's done to you. What she's always done to you makes you belligerent. That's what it is." "It's not belligerence, it's fucking freedom. That's what she gives me, Ma. Freedom to be myself. Liberty." "Liberty," Ma said mockingly, and stood there shaking her head, a crafty smile spreading across her face. I was annoyed to think that she could come so quickly back from the disgusting thing I'd just done to her. I think I would have halted in my tracks, thrown myself down at her feet, begging her forgiveness had she, say, started to cry. But no, she'd gotten a taste for a row, was going to stand her ground, and she did, and she looked just like she did in the poster on the wall by the shop door, and it was then I realised she fucking loved it. The drama, the operatic proportions of things, the rows between us. Come on, Ma, let's go to bed, I said, afraid for the thing to get out of hand, and all too aware that both of us had easy access to a gun. I've heard a few things about Martha Cassidy and her fabulous singing career. Oh, I've heard plenty. Like, what have you heard, and from whom? The biddies round this way, they'd make muck of a saint, I said. It wasn't a biddy who told me, Ma said. Who told you? Never you fucking mind who told me. Don't swear, Ma. It doesn't suit you. Told you what? Just how your precious Martha Cassidy's been making a living over there. And it's not by singing, it's by lying on her back, best way she knows how. I looked at my mother, at her mouth, all foamy and thin and twisted, and all the horrific stories I would read in the newspapers each day came suddenly into my mind, instantly metamorphosed as stories with me and Ma in the starring roles. Son bludgeons own mother to death in row. Meryl Streep mowed down in Castlemoyne. Son of woman who ruined his relationship with the love of his life and caused her firstborn son to stop taking his insulin in order to get the fuck away from her, turns nasty and shoots his mother's head clean off. All this zipped through my brain along with the words Ma had just said about Martha earning her keep in a supine position as the two of us stood there, simmering with rage in the alcohol-scented room. And way, way, way back towards my spinal cortex, a little thought started up that just maybe my mother was right about Martha. This was the terrible, insidious hold Ma had on me, that even when she was spiteful and wicked, a part of me thought she was right.